Okay, you've been listening to us entertain, teach, possibly bore you all week. And now it's your turn to give us some feedback, okay, and maybe bore us with your questions. So it's really open to any sort of topic. I mean, even though it's a theory seminar, try to keep it to theory, but there's no really sharp, bright line between the theory and policy. So if you're not sure of what your question, where your question lies, ask it anyway. We do have a number of questions that were written in advance by students, and we'll go through some of them, and then hopefully that will generate and spark some ideas, and that you can come up with questions spontaneously. We'll go, there's a little mistake on the schedule. We'll go from 4 to 4:45, then change rooms if you want, and then restart again at 5 o'clock and go another 45 minutes. Okay. Okay, the first question is as follows. Is observation necessary to formulate the action axiom? That is, don't we need to observe humans to know what they are and deduce why they act? Do you want me to read that again, David?
No, can I?
Okay, thanks.
Well, I think this question is confusing how we get the concepts that are in the action axiom with how we know that the action axiom is true. It may be, depending on your view of how we acquire concepts, that we have to observe the world or observe human beings to acquire the concepts of action or human beings. But it doesn't follow from that the way we know the action axiom is through observation. There, at least if the Austrian view is right, it would be just by thinking about it. So it's not how we acquire the concepts, it's what we do with the concepts once we've gotten them.
Also, just quickly to add to that, I'm sometimes unsure whether humans act is the best way of expressing what the idea behind the action axiom is supposed to be. Because, what's supposed to be a priori is not that members of a certain biological species act. Right. I mean, depending on what counts as a member of a biological species, you might think that someone who's in a permanent vegetative state is a human but doesn't act. And you certainly could think that there are things that could act without being humans. Intelligent extraterrestrials could act without being human. If by human you mean something biological, if by human you meant something like a person or an agent, when you say an agent's act, it's getting close to being a tautology. But at least what action axiom establishes this much, it establishes that action exists. I mean, praxeology is just sort of a set of truths about action that you might think could be true even if there were no actual actions in the world. I mean, it might be true that action necessarily involves the application of means to ends and preferring your first choice over your second, et cetera, even if there were no agents, those might be true. But since you can't deny the action axiom without acting, in some sense, what the action axiom establishes is that there are agents, or at least there's at least one. There is such a thing as action. And I'm not sure that it's that important that it be members of a particular kind of primate.
Wait, do you mean by the very fact that someone is stating the proposition, that it establishes by that fact that there's at least one actor? I missed that.
Or that you can't. It'd be self-refuting to deny it, because okay. If you deny that you're acting, you're okay. Purposefully denying it.
Okay. The second question is, what is the quintessential characteristic that gives people something we refer to as a natural right? Then you'll correct it.
Well, there are different views about that. That would depend on what ethical theory you held. I mean, someone might claim that because it's said that human beings by nature have certain rights. I mean, then they would be whatever they thought was the. Say human nature being rational would be one thing that's frequently given as the source of rights. If you held some sort of view that rights come from some natural properties, then you take whatever you thought the essential natural property, rationality, is one. Now, you might just, on the other hand, you might just hold that there are certain intuitively obvious truths about morality, one of which is that human beings have rights. If you took that view, then you wouldn't be appealing, I think, to any... You would be claiming human beings have an essence on that view, but you wouldn't be claiming that the rights stem from that essence. So I think it would depend on what theory of rights you held. I don't think we could give a single answer to that that would just hold for any theory. Now for the corrections.
Well, this isn't a correction, just an addendum. Wow. If you think of rights as being rights to do things, that's not the only way to think of rights. But if you do think of rights as rights to do things, then it seems as though only agents could have them. That would rule out non-agents. Also, on the question of here's a possible reason. I'm not saying this is decisive. Here's a possible reason for thinking that non-human animals, or at least non-reasoning animals, don't have rights. I think that a right involves the permissibility of defending your right or something like that. And if animals aren't moral agents, if you think you have to be a rational agent to be a moral agent, then animals can't be praised or blamed. They don't have moral responsibilities. You can't talk about they're having rights. And you might say, well, what about people in comas and so forth? Can we exercise rights on their behalf? Well, yeah, we can. But I think we think something like, when you act on behalf of a comatose patient, what you have the right to do is to do what, as far as you can tell, they would do if their rational capacity weren't impaired. You make decisions for them on the basis of what they would do if their rational capacity were not impaired. But the problem with animals, it's not that their rational capacity is impaired. There's no such thing as their rational capacity. If they were rational, they'd just be a different kind of creature entirely. So there's nothing there's no way you can act on their behalf. At least that's my suggestion. Don't hold me to it.
Okay, who would win in a fight, DiLorenzo or Klein? My money's on D'Lo. He's an Italian guy, knows all the dirty tricks. Serious question, okay.
No one wanted that one.
Okay, here's one for the hardcore real scientists. What is the main problem of the theory of monetary equilibrium? For example, Horwitz, White, etc. What do they forget to take into account in their theory? What question would you advise us to ask them to reveal the weakness of their theory? Well, Roger's the most sympathetic to that, so I'll... Roger, why don't you just explain the theory of monetary equilibrium in a few words?
Well, I'm not sure I am. I'm not sure what... are you talking about the...
The Hegelian monetary disequilibrium stuff that, that George and...
Yeah.
I don't know if Larry even...
Well... monetary disequilibrium, as I understand it, dates to Warburton. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, George's stuff. You need to increase the demand for money. The supply of money in response to a demand, increasing the demand for cash balances.
Yeah.
You have to keep the spending stream constant.
Yeah, yeah. Sure. That theory, actually, it's a recommendation by Hayek when he argues in terms of the equation of exchange. And I think one way to get the story straight is that Hayek's first cut at that just assumed, without question, the existence of a central bank. And he argued that any sort of deflation, meaning in this sense a decrease in the price level, that was brought about by increased productivity or increased output is harmless, and it's a benign deflation, and there should be no response from the central bank. If technology is improved, if productivity is increased, the economy produces more output, fine, it sells at a lower price. So simply let prices adjust to the new economic realities caused by those kind of economic events. And he spelled that out just to distinguish it from the other case where inflation, meaning, again, increase in the price level, is brought about by monetary creation. And there, of course, he was opposed to it, that the government should not be increasing the money supply even to offset what otherwise would be a decline in the price level. He argued this early on, and even in the late 20s when he was visiting at NYU, the Federal Reserve was doing exactly that during the 20s. And Hayek called it artificial price stabilization. That's a term that would be incomprehensible to a monetarist, I think, because constant price level is their goal. But his point was that even if the central bank is increasing the money supply at a rate to keep prices from falling, it nonetheless causes distortions of the business cycle sort. And so he was against it. In later writings, he backed away from, he dropped the assumption of a central bank. In fact, he argued that the so-called, what he called the ideal policy, and he put that in quotation marks, meaning that the central bank probably wouldn't have the ability to distinguish whether prices were going down because of increased output or some other reason. And they wouldn't necessarily have the will to manipulate the money supply in accordance with his so-called ideal. So, so he realized ideal meant they can't do it. Later on, though, when he turned his attention to competitive banking, he argued that the competition among banks essentially give you that result, that with competition among banks, the competitive solution is increasing the money supply or not increasing the money supply when the new output appears that simply lets prices fall. And if individual banks do increase the money supply for whatever reason, they end up doing themselves in and not doing the whole economy in. And so that's why he would favor free banking in that context.
What, you want to respond to anything, Peter?
No, I think this is a fair characterization of the opinions of Hayek and the monetary equilibrium school. The question was, what is the, are there any weaknesses in the assumptions of the theory, and what you should ask Professor White or Professor Selden when you meet them? Well, I won't really answer to this latter question, since you have to make out yourself. But I mean, the one weakness in the theoretical construction and in the writings, as far as I've seen, is simply that the starting point is taken for granted without being really argued through. It's taken for granted that it's a good thing that you stabilize aggregate spending, so that if you have real growth in the economy, the price level would drop, but that's not really harmful, and it's not explained why this would not be harmful as compared to other cases in which the monetary conditions change. So most notably a case in which the demand for money, for example, might increase, so that aggregate spending might diminish, or in which you have massive bank failure so that the money supply would diminish because most of the money supply is being produced by commercial banks. So this would entail a massive reduction of aggregate spending. And so the main problem as I see it is not that what Selden and White state is necessarily wrong, but that they draw sometimes conclusions from their analysis that are not warranted by that what they have examined. Because in order to have the full picture, you need to take into account also an analysis of those consequences that would follow if the monetary conditions change. Now, this is what I and a few others, based on Murray Rothbard's work, have started to do. And, well, the conclusion to which I have come is that really there's no reason why we should call the changes that are imposed on the structure of production coming from the monetary side, why we should call those changes inefficient or unwarranted or undesirable as compared to changes that would come through higher savings that entail a lengthening of the structure of production and a falling price level.
I just want to say one thing to add to what Professor Garrison said. in prices and production, Hayek did define neutral money as a constancy of the aggregate spending in the economy. That is, if what he called velocity slows down, if people start to spend money slow, which means they demand more money, then the policy that would keep money neutral to the real economy, wouldn't interfere with changes in relative prices, is to increase the money supply to offset the drop in velocity. However, later on in the book, he defines neutral money that way, but later on in the book he says this would be impossible of actually implementing. The reason why is, he said, because you would have to increase the supply of money and inject it just at that point where the person or group of people increase their demand. Because other, if you inject it at some other point, that process would still continue, and you would have another process, now an inflationary process going on while this deflationary process is going at the same time. Eventually they would meet, but all those price changes would take place anyway. And then added on top of that, you'd have the inflationary price changes. So that's, I just wanted to add that in there, but I don't want to spend too much time on that. He did say that, I recall.
Yeah,
okay.
The
ideal was not possible to achieve.
It's questionable whether it's an ideal, but it's not possible.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, if it's on this point. Yeah, okay, fine. That's good.
You had mentioned Hayek said that you shouldn't increase the money supply. And when you were mentioning that there are certain times where you can increase the money supply, is that an Austrian view or a Main Street view?
Well, that's a Hayek view. I didn't deal with the case.
I didn't deal with the case that that Joe mentioned, which I probably should have. That Joe's dealing with the instance of a decrease in velocity. In other words, if people decide they want to hold more money, okay? And let me deal with it summarily in a way that is at least implausible, if not impossible. But suppose that everybody decide they want to hold more money. Then it's possible for the monetary authority or competitive banking, for that matter, to supply that money without causing price inflation, because the whole idea is they want to hold it. If they're holding it and not spending it, it doesn't bid up prices. All right. But it's implausible that everybody's demand for holding money would rise at the same time, and it's problematic that the new money could be spread evenly over the population to satisfy that. And Joe's certainly right that if the people over here want to hold more money, but the bank injects money over here to accommodate that, then there's some Cantillon effects, there's some relative price effects until that money gets shuffled over to the people who actually want to hold it. But another point to be made is in competitive banking, strictly from the individual's bank's point of view, if the bank creates more money that people want to hold, that works well for the people who are holding it and for the bank. There's no negative repercussions either way. If they create money that others don't want to hold, not only causes inflation, but it will do in the bank that issued the money. The overissue will come back and haunt that bank and won't destroy the whole economy like a central bank would if it inflates in that way.
Okay. Shifting gears a little bit. How can we make normative claims on government spending if we cannot make interpersonal utility comparisons? Well, I think the easy answer there is we can't. Okay. We can't make, you have to bring ethics into making any policy judgment. I know Tim Terrell emphasized this in his lectures. And then for the panel, if we cannot know that Peter lost more than Paul gained through government spending, must we not be agnostic on spending? Okay, you want to read it? If we cannot know that Peter lost more than Paul gained through government spending, must we not be agnostic on spending? Well, we can say a few things. We can say this. We can say that since government spending involves financing in some way, either through inflation, borrowing, or taxation, that somebody is getting a reduced amount of resources. So that person is injured. And even if a new hospital is built or something altruistic is achieved, even in that case, you cannot say scientifically that social utility has increased, precisely because you can't make interpersonal comparisons. Some people benefit, other people lose. That's Rothbard's point. But, of course, that also does not prevent us from tracing out the positive effects of an increase in government spending, crowding out private investment, reducing labor productivity, and so on. Now, that's not normative. We could go on and say, and this is bad because it's robbery or because it has bad utilitarian effects, but as economists, speaking as purely as economists, we don't make those statements. Okay? If an economist makes that statement, he's speaking as a citizen with a certain code of ethics. Murray Rothbard always emphasized that economists should not smuggle value judgments into their positive analysis. They should give the positive analysis, but they should reveal their ethical presuppositions or their codes of ethics that they use in then judging the outcomes. But somebody else want to take that? Any, is that clear? Because I think I noticed in the question some confusion on that point. Okay, economists cannot. An economist can tell you if you have 90% taxation, incentives to work, incentives to invest are going to be destroyed, and we're going to be a lot poorer. They can't go on and say this is a bad thing, not as economists. Okay. If they do, then they're making an ethical judgment, and then they're obligated to give us their system of ethics that they're using to make that judgment. It's not just that they can say, okay, well, here's my judgment on it. No, as a scholar, you have to go on and explain the underlying ethics. Okay. Okay, to Roderick Long, and Roderick Long alone.
I'm not alone.
On your personal blog, Austro-Athenian Empire, you say that you are a left libertarian, and it's in scare quotes. What does this political view contain? Does it go beyond the classical libertarian conception of individual freedom and private property rights? You just want to give a little?
Sure. Okay. Well, short version. Left libertarianism, as I understand it, doesn't involve a disagreement with, I'm not sure what I'm supposed to call it, the non-left libertarians. I had argued with Stephen Kinsella as to what I was supposed to call them. He didn't like most of the terms I came up with for him.
Yeah, but most of them were profane.
Well, sure. We still didn't like them. As I understand it, it's not for the most part a disagreement about what rights are. It's rather an idea. It's partly a question about what we think the results of implementing libertarianism would be, and left libertarianism in this sense thinks that a lot of left-wing goals would actually be achieved, that you'd get a society that's much closer to what a lot of leftists have advocated, so there's a through free markets. So it's partly a question about to what extent features of existing society are the results of the state or the results of the market. Then also this idea that there's a natural fit between certain left cultural values and libertarian cultural values. But if you really want to know the details, probably the best place to look is not my blog, but another website I created, the Alliance of the Libertarian Left. I didn't create the alliance, I just created the website. If you look for the website, it's all-left.org.net. I don't remember. Just search for Alliance of the Libertarian Left.
Okay, thanks. Do you consider cash saving, that is hoarded cash savings, hoarded money, to be, as W.H. Hutt says, that a person is investing in money? If so, does saving equal investment? Anybody want to take a crack at that? Do you want to read it again? Got it?
Yep.
Okay. Yes. That's the short version.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, the investment in the first thing to notice about savings is that you cannot save without investing at the same time. Saving is, by definition, that part of our past revenue which is not consumed. Now, if we are in a barter economy, which we don't use money, And we have a real, only real income. We have a certain amount of apples that we have picked on the previous day. Some of those we do eat and give away to friends that eat them and so on, and others we keep aside. That's our savings. And having saved, we have at the same time also made an investment. Now, through exchanges on the market, we can transform our investment. We can exchange the apples for something else. If we don't consume that something else, we have again saved that part of our past revenue. We have only given it a different investment. In the case of a monetary economy, it's not fundamentally different. Our revenue always comes in the form of money revenue. Part of this is used for expenditure on consumer goods. Part of this is not spent on consumer goods, and may then be used, for example, to buy shares of companies or to give credit to banks or other market participants, so to make an investment. But the important point is that before we even start spending that money on investment goods or start buying shares of other companies, we have already made an investment by just keeping these savings in the monetary form. So cash hoards are the primitive or the original form of savings. And they distinguish themselves from other forms of primitive forms of investment, right? Always. And they distinguish themselves from the other forms of investment in that they are less directed. They do not only benefit certain investment projects, they might also benefit consumption of other people. Right? This is the point that Hatte stressed and that the Austrians stress, and that those who increase their hoards do not use their money. And because this exercises a pressure on the price level, the purchasing power of everybody else's money units will increase. So we are giving a greater weight to the decisions of all other market participants. So the relationship between that kind of saving and investment in productive projects is a little less direct than in the case of other investment, but fundamentally it's a form of savings.
Does anybody else want to respond on the panel to that? Okay. If it's on this question.
Yeah, yes. I was going to add on to that. I guess the follow-up question would be, if there's some kind of gold boom or gold rush, do you think that could possibly lead to a discoordination, intertemporal discoordination of the economy?
Well, the discoordination takes place to the effect that the market participants engage in mutually contradictory projects, and that cannot be all executed at the same time. So in the ideal case in which we have perfect coordination, we have a situation of general equilibrium. Right? Now, the question is it because people invest in gold, or maybe because there's a gold mania or something like this? Well, mania, okay, this is it's a different case maybe. But if there's a massive investment in gold, maybe because the investment environment is very bad, does this all by itself entail some disequilibria? Is this a disequilibrium movement? I don't see this necessarily. It's easy here too, right? We talked before about the danger of smuggling value judgments into economic analysis. It's very often a shortcut. It's an intellectual shortcut to denounce a consequence of people's choices that you do not like personally. You qualify this as discoordinating or inefficient is another code word, right? And very often you smuggle a value judgment into the analysis in this way. So it's not necessarily the case that massive investment in gold and silver involve a disequilibrium, major disequilibrium in the economy. It could be an important step to redress a disequilibrium situation that presently exists and turn the economy over to a new equilibrium. It's difficult to say this at the moment when it happens.
Okay. Last question on this.
Dr. Wilson,
speak up.
If hoarded money does count as present investment and savings equals investment, how do you explain the disequilibrium between savings and investment during the business cycle? At that point, are savings and investment not in line with each other?
Well, the disequilibrium comes from the fact that you make a wrong use of your investment, you invest in such a way that the projects cannot be executed, cannot be realized. And this is the great subject of the Austrian business cycle theory. You have intertemporal equilibrium that means you are using your savings in such a way that is out of tune with the preferences of the consumers. That's one possibility. Or you are starting too many investment projects that are physically cannot all be completed. Right? So savings is equal to investment, but you have made wrong investments. Right? So the problem is not that savings are unequal to investment, it's simply that investment is bad.
Let Roger pick.
Yeah, a lot of, I agree with most of what Guido said. But the distinction, you know, there are two views. One is that saving always equals investment. You see that in principles texts. And income always equals expenditures, which is really a different version of the same thing. On the other hand, the equality of income and expenditures, or the equality of saving and investment, is taken to be an equilibrium condition. The economy is in equilibrium when saving equal investment, as brought about by movements in the interest rate and so on. Typically, in the textbooks, sort of accounting identity, the instance where they're always equal, it involves counting excess inventories as if they were investment. And there's you can make that case. You can claim that, okay, you invested in a bunch of inventories. I think it probably would offend the businessman who's holding all those inventories. Oh, I see you've invested in a lot of inventories this year. No, we didn't, you know, we just can't unload them, that's all. But the accountant doing national income accounts would call all of those excess inventories investment, okay? And maybe it's unintended investment. Maybe you wish you hadn't and so on, or you didn't mean to. But it's called investment, and that's the kind of thing that makes those two things necessarily equal. One thing I'll point out, I'd say I don't like that kind of terminology. I like to save those concepts, saving and investment, allowing them to be unequal, and allowing some disequilibrium there, so we can talk about business cycles and so on. You could make the same distinction. In fact, some economists have. In microeconomics, you could say quantity supplied always equal quantity demanded. If you count the excess inventories, that is, the surplus, as effectively being demanded by the supplier. It's called reservation demand. Philip Vixte did that, a British economist. So in that sense, quantity supplied always equals quantity demanded. Well, okay, you can say that, but make sure you're pointing out that what otherwise you would call a surplus, you're claiming was demanded by the supplier. Otherwise, he would have dumped it at whatever price it would have brought in the marketplace. All right. So a lot of this is semantics, and you just have to understand what's being included and what not in the definition of saving and investment, or in quantity supplied and quantity demanded. Let me make one more point, and the one that Guido also made, but I think it deserves emphasis, is that if you save in the form of cash as opposed to saving by putting your money at interest, then the unconsumed resources that are that are implied by your saving are allocated in a different way. They're allocated by reductions in price of those unconsumed resources rather than allocated by reductions in the interest rate that the business people can borrow cheap credit and so on and undertake investment activities. So it really is a question of what the market mechanism is that puts those unconsumed resources in the hands of somebody else who uses them instead of you.
Okay. Here's a question that's designed, that's guaranteed to render David Gordon speechless. That's why I'm reading it. Do you think that the method of argumentation ethics, Van Dunn, Hoppe, and Kinsella, and by the way, this is addressed to Gordon and Wong, do you think this method can be a fruitful way of establishing libertarian political philosophy, David?
I for many years, refused to answer that question. get me into too much trouble. I would say, let me just
why
give.
Why would it get you in trouble?
Well, answering that question would get me into trouble also. Let me just give a very. I know Roderick has, in past years, we've given a seminar on ethics and economics. We didn't do this year, where Roderick has a very elaborate analysis of Hans Hoppe's argument. Criticize it. I would just say there. All I'll say is there may be something to it. I'm not sure what. And I'll leave it at that.
You hear that, Hans?
It was a little bit like Judge Napolitano's answer to the question whether he was an anarchist last night. Here are a couple of my criticisms of Hoppe's argument, or reasons I don't accept it. If you don't know what Hoppe's argument is, then I'm not going to take time to explain it now. So, the idea that you're not justified in accepting any claim unless it's something that could be defended in an argumentative exchange with another person seems to me wrong, because you can imagine a case in which you'd be justified in believing you're the only person left alive. You can imagine having evidence for that if something sufficiently nasty happened out there. But obviously, the claim that you're the only person left alive violates the conditions of interpersonal argumentative exchange. So that's one of my worries. Another one is, it seems to me that engaging in argumentative exchange with someone, you don't have to grant the legitimacy of their controlling their bodies. You might just say it's unfortunately, you're controlling your body, I have to argue with you rather than just whacking you as I'd prefer. Just as if someone's attacking you, you're defending yourself presupposes that they're attacking you, but doesn't presuppose the legitimacy of their attacking you. And also, it doesn't seem to me that the control you need over your body in order to engage in argumentation is complete self-ownership. You could be bound hand and feet and still argue, or if you're Italian, you could be bound by your feet and still argue, and it wouldn't have complete self-ownership. So that's just a short version of some of my worries.
Okay.
But we have defenders up here, so if anyone wants to take a crack at...
Well, I must say, there might be something to it, but I don't see it. If you are all alone, you are the only person in the world that is left. I mean, what use would we have of a social philosophy? It just doesn't apply. And so in this case, I mean, the point is to establish property rights. And of course, property rights, you only need them if there are at least two persons. So let's say you believe you're the only one left in the world, then of course, Hoppe's theory does not apply, but that's not the point, right? The point is to explain situations in which there are at least two. The other points, you might be bound by your feet and so on, but so you say you still argue, so there's still some control that you exercise. And I mean, it's not even that, as far as I understood Hans's argument, the point is not the legitimacy of ownership, but the undoubted fact. It's a fact around which you cannot get that the other person in front of you is the owner of himself. There's nobody else who owns him. There's nobody else who controls at least his thought. We might chop off his arm and then use the arm as we see fit. Right? But nobody can use the arm but him. So nobody can use his thoughts but himself, and that's a fact. So the question of legitimacy comes after this. It's by recognizing that there is this fact that's the reason why I make arguments. And if somebody makes a claim to explain why it would be this or that person should be the owner of this or that object, by making the claim, he recognizes that the other person is able to accept or reject this argument, that is a self-owner. So that's a presupposition that we make in any argument. Finally, do we not need to argue at all? Well, yes, of course. In order to make claims. In order to claim property, we need to make an argument. We need to say, well, I am the owner of this or that because this or that or that. Otherwise, there's no justification. And justification always involves argument. Well, that would be my brief version on this.
Okay.
Well, can I just say just one very brief point? On the first point you raised, I think it's right that at least most problems of ethics wouldn't arise if there were a single person. I mean, one could raise the question of whether people have duties to themselves. But that's a different question from the question of whether every assertion about ethics requires argument, interpersonal exchange to show that that assertion is true.
But the
fact that if individuals are by themselves, we might not have a need for ethics doesn't answer that. I mean, it might well be that, supposing it were the case that an individual thinking by himself might be able to come up with true propositions about ethics, even though there aren't any other people around. I don't see why not offhand.
Okay. Philosophers. If we can't convince mainstream economists on our methodology, should we try to convince them via empirical evidence? I'll just take a little bit and then what you guys think about it. I think that question is sort of misleading. I don't think we want, if you're doing economics, you're not trying to convince any particular other economist. I mean, you want to put it in a way that your argument is persuasive in some sense, but if you're doing Austrian economics, you're doing a certain economics based on a certain methodology, and the point or purpose is to advance Austrian economics or praxeological economics. So as to convincing other people, that's something that generally happens in them just reading your argument and thinking that it strikes a chord in them and responding favorably to it. I don't think skepticism about the methodology, we should worry about that too much, that we should try to convince them of the methodology first or something. Okay. You just do economics based on that methodology, and it's persuasive or not. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes evidence can be very persuasive, but the Austrians are clear that they're not limiting their evidence to the econometrics that's being used by the mainstream. Right. Evidence means more full-bodied evidence, including sort of a full-bodied history, not just a history of things that can be counted in history of things for which there's readily available data and so on. So sometimes a historical understanding of an episode it can be more persuasive, give rise to more persuasion than simply regressing equations and so on.
Okay. We'll stop here for a 15-minute break, and then you can either come back here or go to the other panel. Okay? But we have more questions here if you want to come back
here. Let's all go to the other panel.